Economies are opening up slowly. In summer months, it's weird for people not to think about travel. A big worry for this hotel operator in a tourist hotspot in Canada.
And how many rooms do we have today, Raj? 12? A 300-room hotel, we got 12. So, you know, you got your whole floor to yourself.
Also, a member of a highly secretive ruling family takes to social media to complain about his cousin, the president. For Syrians, it's must-see TV.
They are sitting and watching those videos because it's just too suspenseful to miss.
And cue the silent laughter. Some comedians now practice their craft cooped up inside.
There's no reason why I shouldn't post that weird front-facing video of my mom yelling at me 100 times in Spanish, what am I doing as I go about my day?
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you. Almost every day, there's news about yet another company making strides on a coronavirus vaccine. When it's ready, the world will need upwards of 7 billion doses. That is a lot of vaccinations and potentially a lot of money for the company that cracks the vaccine code. But this is a public health emergency. Enter public-private partnerships. One was announced today between the American pharmaceutical giant Merck and the nonprofit scientific research organization IAVI. Mark Feinberg is the president and CEO of IAVI. Dr. Feinberg, what does this partnership indicate in terms of whether either entity will make money off of this vaccine?
Well, really, I think both organizations are doing this specifically to address the public health need. It's not an intention to generate a profit.
So does that suggest that the vaccine that Merck and IAVI create will be patent-free?
Well, I think the issue is not intellectual property or patents. The issue is really what the efforts are that go into making a candidate vaccine available in an affordable and accessible way to everyone who needs it. As you know, we're facing a challenge that the world has never seen before. You know, many, many billions of doses are going to need to be made of the vaccine if we're going to truly have a chance of eradicating this pandemic. And not only does that mean that public sector and private sector partners really each have a responsibility to engage in solving that challenge, but it's going to require totally new models of partnership. And really, no one organization can do it alone, which is, I think, why the Merck and IAVI partnership is but one example of many. I think it also speaks to the fact that even one company or one vaccine is likely not going to solve the problem, that we probably will need multiple vaccines that are demonstrated to be safe and efficacious.
The main question here, Dr. Feinberg, though, is for-profit companies have a right to make money. I mean, they're in business and there is money involved here. So who's making it?
Well, I think it's too early to comment on any, you know, potential to generate a profit. But, you know, having worked at Merck for over a decade and, you know, now running an organization that is specifically intended to meet the needs of the world's poorest people and do that in a manner where we don't profit. I mean, I think both of our organizations are primarily focused on addressing the global health threat before us.
How does the effort between IAVI, your organization, and Merck differ from the nearly 100 other efforts out there to create a vaccine?
Well, one really important element for both us and Merck is that the Merck success with the Ebola vaccine development, you know, that vaccine is, you know, highly efficacious against a really terrible disease. And Merck, through a tremendous effort, brought that vaccine to licensure by the leading regulatory authorities, the FDA, the EMA in Europe, as well as a number of African regulatory authorities. And it's been pre-qualified by the WHO, which is their stamp of approval.
How far along are IAVI and Merck on creating a vaccine for the coronavirus? And will you be doing human trials first?
Well, we are still in preclinical stages. We're working as quickly as we possibly can to get into clinical trials. But as you know, there are a number of steps that are necessary that best protects the volunteers who participate in those studies. Our hope is to move as quickly as possible to generate the foundation to support clinical investigation. And we hope to be initiating clinical trials by the fourth quarter of this year.
Mark Feinberg, the president and CEO of the scientific nonprofit IAVI. Dr. Feinberg, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
As the world anxiously looks for hope from a vaccine, the spread of the pandemic has shifted yet again. Latin America now has more daily infections than Europe and the United States.
There can be no doubt our region has become the epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic.
That's Dr. Carissa Etienne, director of the World Health Organization for the Americas. She was speaking this morning. The outlook in South America is bleak, not just for public health reasons, but also because of the economic fallout there. For more on how the economies to our south are responding to the pandemic, we turn to the world's Jorge Valencia. Jorge, Bank of America is projecting the region's economy will shrink by almost 7% this year. What reasons are economists giving for this really severe downturn?
Well, it's complicated, as is everything, but you can break it down into three main categories. The first one is that from Mexico to Argentina, to varying degrees, there are poor healthcare systems. The second one is that countries in Latin America have very little ability to inject money into the economy to create a stimulus, as we've seen here in the United States and we've seen in Europe. And the third one is that there are people who are immediately in need, because in Latin America, about half the people, half the working force are off the books, people who live basically on what they earn every day. I spoke about this with Alex Bacora. He's an economist from Brazil, and he really wanted to emphasize that the equation with people in need in Latin America is very different from what we see in Europe and here in the United States.
So my concern here is, okay, the developed countries, they can't afford to compete against the virus using lockdowns, using longer quarantines, and even giving money to people that need, like the U.S. is giving this check. For us, for poorer countries, this is way more complex, you know, because we cannot afford to stay at home for long.
There's a lot of work across Latin America that happens kind of in the shadows. It's informal. It's often cash labor. No taxes are paid. So what are governments across the region doing to help these millions of informal workers?
Not a lot. And there is a large need across the entire region. In fact, the United Nations arm that does economic development, they are proposing actually a monthly payment for 6 months of $146 every month for 6 months to the people who are most greatly in need. They're saying that's 215 million people across the region. About a third of the people in Latin America, they say, have this need. And even though it seems like it's not a lot of money, 146, that's just so that people can eat and pay their basic necessities. And it's unlikely to happen.
And who are some of the most vulnerable groups of people? Who are we talking about?
The pandemic preys on inequality. So in Latin America, for example, the people who are the most affected are people of Native background, people of Afro-Latino background. And the largest group are women. In Latin America, as is the case in the United States, women are more educated, but they are less employed. Claudia Piras, she's an economist at the Inter-American Development Bank. She gave a presentation about this at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
Based on what we know, I feel pretty confident to say that the crisis will exacerbate the gender gaps already present in Latin America, placing women in a more vulnerable situation than men.
So a lot of these disparities that existed before the pandemic are now being either brought to light or they are being exacerbated as the pandemic continues.
The world's Jorge Valencia laying out some of the basics of what the coronavirus is doing to Latin American economies. Jorge, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
For a lot of Americans, the start of the summer holiday season is a time to head north to Canada. Not this year. The border between Canada and the U.S. has been closed to all but essential travel since mid-March, and it's going to stay that way until at least June 21st. Anita Elash went to the Niagara region on the Canadian side of the border to find out what Canadians have to say about the closure.
On a normal day in late May, the Oaks Hotel in Niagara Falls, Ontario, would be crawling with tourists, many of them Americans. But things are not normal here, and the city is deserted.
Well,
hello.
How are you?
And when I meet Vince Cario, who owns the Oaks, he and a receptionist are the only other people in the lobby.
And how many rooms do we have today, Raj? 12? Okay. A 300-room hotel, we got 12.
Wow.
So, you know, you got your whole floor to yourself.
After 2 months of lockdown, businesses in Ontario are slowly starting to reopen. Cario has spent a lot of time putting social distancing and other safety measures in place.
Hand sanitizers, staff training,
room cleanliness, you know, sanitize the rooms. Because we want it to be safe for our guests and want it to be safe for my staff. So we're doing everything that we're told to do.
But so far, customers have not returned.
We think that the summer is going to be dismal. Maybe we'll do 50% of the people we did last year. Maybe. You know, we're not looking to make any money. This is not going to be a year where we make any money. If we pay our bills, we'll be happy. But I mean, that's even a stretch.
About a quarter of Cario's customers come from the U.S. He says having those guests come back could make the difference between paying the bills or not paying them. But he's asking the Canadian government to keep the border closed. New York State has had one of the biggest coronavirus outbreaks in the U.S. Cario worries that if the border opens too soon, he'll also lose the Canadian customers he's counting on this summer.
Why? Why would we take that risk? You know, for economics, I think we want to make sure that this doesn't come back. So I think that's what they're saying, too. Make sure that this doesn't come back. You open the border prematurely, and we get a second or a third wave of this, and it gets worse. No one's going to want to come here, maybe for 5 years.
A recent poll found that half of Canadians want the border to stay closed at least until the end of this year. Beth Jackson won't go quite that far, but she says she's happy the border is closed for now.
It's never been closed that I'm aware of. So for it to be closed, it's got to be serious. Like, everybody has to chill out.
Jackson lives in Crystal Beach, a tourist town on the north shore of Lake Erie. We meet across the street from the Tim Hortons coffee shop. Dine-in service is banned for now. Jackson is having her coffee seated on a lawn chair, 6 feet away from her friend, Lori Shute. And Jackson admits she's having trouble chilling out.
The anxiety in me since this has been going on is incredible.
Jackson has family on the U.S. side of the border. Her mom lives in Amherst, New York, a 45-minute drive away. Her brother is just a little further down the road. Until the border closed, they saw each other at least once a week. Now they use FaceTime.
You don't like being kept from your parents. Like, my mom and I have a friendship, a very close relationship. So it's really hard.
But Jackson says she's worried that people south of the border are just not taking the pandemic seriously. Her mom tells her most people there are not wearing masks when they go out, and they don't respect social distancing guidelines.
If they don't believe in it, they believe it's a flu. When they get here, they're not going to social distance, they're not going to use masks, they're not going to clean their hands, they're just not. And we don't know who has it. Like, we're close friends, and we have not hugged since this all started.
Jackson's friend Lori says it's the protests south of the border that scare her.
Because when you see people in Detroit outside the legislature with guns because they really don't believe in this, they all want to go back to work. They want the economy to fully open. Okay. You don't want those people coming here. I don't. It's the attitude I don't want here.
Last week, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced that Canada and the U.S. decided to extend the border closure through June 21st. The Canadian government says it's looking at how it might improve screening to prevent people infected with coronavirus from crossing. For the world, I'm Anita Elash, Niagara Region, Ontario.
Venezuela is drenched in black gold, so why does it need Iran to deliver oil? That's just ahead. You're with the world.
The world supporters include Subtitle, a podcast about how we speak.
All of human languages are products of human brains and bodies.
We talk with comedians, politicians, anyone who thinks about language. Alien languages, too.
If I were a sphere with 9 eyes or 9 sensory organs placed around my diameter, how would that affect things?
Subtitle. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Venezuela sits atop the world's largest oil reserves, and yet the country does not have enough gasoline right now. So Venezuelan leaders appeared thrilled when the first of 5 oil tankers arrived from Iran.
Quiero agradecer desde el corazón
Venezuela's leader, Nicolas Maduro, heaped praise on Iran for selling Venezuela some oil. Risa Grace Targo is following the situation there. She's a Venezuela analyst at the Eurasia Group, a political risk consulting firm. So, Risa, Venezuela is a country with so much oil that at one point in recent years, they were practically giving gasoline away to their people. So why is Venezuela thrilled with the arrival of these tankers from Iran now?
So gasoline shortages have become the principal problem in the country. This is due both to a real lack of domestic refining capacity, with a lot of domestic refineries shuttered, and then also crippling U.S. sanctions and the current oil price, which has made it very difficult for Venezuela to have the type of swap arrangements that they had heading into this crisis.
So U.S. sanctions forbid Iran from selling oil. How risky is it for the Iranians to make this delivery in waters that the U.S. has traditionally thought of as its own sphere of influence?
Well, it's risky, but I think both Iran and Venezuela are making the calculation that the U.S. is distracted dealing with the pandemic here at home and with other foreign policy priorities. Both countries are already heavily sanctioned, and I think that's one of the reasons why this is so appealing to both of them. But in that sense, I think the U.S.'s options are more limited sanctions or otherwise trying to intercept these tankers at sea, which potentially risks escalation. And it seems the Iranians are calculating that the Trump administration is not planning to do that, and that they can go ahead and be provocative without risking that type of military conflict.
Four more Iranian tankers are steaming toward Venezuela. Why do you think blocking their arrival is an option the U.S. would not take at this point?
I mean, I think that the U.S. probably wants to avoid an escalation. You know, this could lead to some sort of incident in the Straits of Hormuz. I think in general, the Trump administration has a lot going on right now and probably doesn't want to risk any sort of escalated conflict with Iran. So, I mean, my sense is that the U.S. is going to respond with kind of limited symbolic sanctions. Obviously, the Trump administration is rejecting this deepened partnership between the two countries. But so far, all signals indicate that they're not going to do anything beyond that.
The ships, according to the website tankertrackers.com, have an estimated 1.5 million barrels of fuel. Is that a lot or a drop in the bucket?
It's a short-term fix. You know, Venezuela is suffering right now from day-long lines around the country as people look for gasoline and, you know, astronomical prices on the black market. In some cases, it's even impossible to find gasoline on the black market. I mean, it's really dire. You know, I think they're going to need more gasoline, whether it's in additional shipments from Iran or trying to resolve the problems at their domestic refiners, which is something that the Iranians are helping them with, but also just looks like something that's going to be very difficult to do given the state of those refiners, the resources and the inputs necessary to do that. And I would say the state-owned oil company PDVSA's track record in managing these types of kind of complex projects.
Risa Grace Targo is a Venezuela analyst at the Eurasia Group, a political risk consulting firm. Thanks for your time, Risa. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Let's check in now with our weekly series, Every 30 Seconds. On average, somewhere in the U.S., a young Latina turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote. Teens like Jacob Cuenca, a Cuban-Mexican-American who lives just south of Miami. Florida is a key battleground state. Cuenca registered there as a Republican, but the pandemic has brought an unexpected twist to how he's looking at the 2020 presidential election. Reporter Danny Rivero from WLRN in Miami has our story.
I first met Jacob 2 months ago at a McDonald's that his mom drove him to. They kicked us out, so we sat to chat on a curb in the parking lot.
Oh, my name is Jacob Russell Cuenca, and I'm a Republican, and I'm going to be voting for the first time in the upcoming election.
Jacob is a high school senior who's starting to develop a political understanding of where he fits into the big picture. And in a swing state as important as Florida, that kind of political understanding could help decide the 2020 presidential election.
I just believe in conservatism. I feel like you can just get it, you can achieve everything just by working hard enough. You know, like nothing can ever like hold you down. Like you can just do whatever you want. Like as long as you have your mindset and you have a dream, you have that like that glare in your eyes, and you like, you know, you can do whatever you want. Honestly, you really can.
If you have an ideal picture in your head about what a conservative Latino 18-year-old might look like, I'm going to go ahead and say, when it comes to Jacob, you're probably way off.
I want to say he's like the embodiment of like, I guess like a rebellious teenager.
That's Jacob's older brother, Tristan.
He kind of has like that Kurt Cobain look to him. He has the blonde hair, listening to a lot of grunge music, a lot of alternative stuff. It's very funny.
Jacob really likes Nirvana, like really likes them. The first time I met him, he had an Incesticide album cover t-shirt. His favorite song by them is Radio Friendly Unit Shifter from the In Utero album. In it, Kurt Cobain interrogates himself, asking why he alternates between this and that, hot and cold. Again, Jacob's brother, Tristan.
Especially when it comes to politics recently, when I've heard my brother speak about certain things, I'm like, Jacob has been doing his research into all this stuff, you know? Kind of going through that phase of, like, not flip-flopping, but kind of weighing the pros and cons of both sides.
Sort of like what Jacob is doing with President Donald Trump. He doesn't really like Trump, but he plans to vote for him. Because for Jacob, Trump at least stands closer to the conservative ideals that he tries to follow.
All right, look, like Trump, like he says like some nonsense and like, and obviously I really don't agree with a lot of things he does, like building the wall or like, and how he thinks like climate change is fake. Like, yeah, like, but you can't like let one person ruin the whole entire party.
Unlike much of the country, Latino culture in South Florida is not dominated by Mexicans. Most immigrants here came from the Caribbean and South America. And that brings a different frame of political reference. Jacob's mom is a Mexican-American Democrat, and his dad is a Cuban-American who voted for Trump and trends more conservative. In his house, Jacob says he grew up hearing stories about Cuba's leftist government. His grandfather, on his dad's side, was a political prisoner there.
He fled from Cuba. He refused communism 2 times, right, and got thrown in jail. And they put him for, like, 9 years of work in the sugarcane fields.
But politically, Jacob says he came to realize he's a Republican on his own, even as he holds some more liberal values like supporting abortion rights. Everything you've heard from Jacob up to this point was from before the coronavirus pandemic hit. I recently caught up with him 2 months in, and some things were starting to change.
My dad's hours have gotten cut, so that's like something that's kind of like scary.
Jacob is having big doubts about the president. That idea of holding his nose and voting for Trump despite his misgivings, he's not so sure about that anymore because of the coronavirus.
It kind of came out of nowhere, and supposedly like the administration knew about like the coronavirus. I don't know. Just the whole thing like flip-flopping like back and forth and all this stuff. I don't know. Just didn't handle it right.
So now Jacob is facing a choice between who he sees as two incompetent candidates. But the new reality of coronavirus now has him leaning in an unexpected direction.
Like a Democrat always helped the little people, the people that are like losing their jobs. So like I think right now, like, I don't know. I think I'd rather vote for Biden than Trump.
He still feels like a Republican, but at this point, Jacob would probably vote for Democrat Joe Biden over President Trump, because he says Biden might be more likely to pass social programs that would help families like his own. For The World, I'm Danny Rivero in Miami.
Jacob's story is part of Every 30 Seconds, a reporting project we produce in partnership with member stations across the country, following young Latino voters throughout the 2020 presidential election. You can check out all their stories at theworld.org/every30seconds. In China, it's a sign of respect to serve someone food with your own chopsticks. In a pandemic, Beijing wants restaurants to stop this. But many believe that could look rude, and people will think,
you don't want to eat with us, why you come, you know? Why you worry about those things?
Health-conscious etiquette, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. You know what they say about airing dirty laundry? Keep it in the family, especially if your family is part of a highly secretive dictatorship. Apparently, they miss that message in Syria. A cousin of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has been going public with his grievances. In a series of Facebook videos, Rami Makhlouf has been complaining about injustices being unleashed on him and his business. The World's Shirin Jafari spoke with a few Syrians about the videos. They say, bring the popcorn.
The scandal even has a nickname. Syrians are calling it the Makhlouf Musalsal. Musalsals are popular TV series that typically air during Ramadan. Only this one is playing out in real life. And the star of this Musalsal is none other than Syria's president Bashar al-Assad and his first cousin Rami Makhlouf.
It is actually very, very suspenseful.
Asar Khattab is a Syrian journalist based in France.
I have friends who have not really cared about following what's happening in Syria. They're Syrians, but they don't really care about following. They've moved on. They went to Germany or to America. But they are sitting and watching those Makhlouf videos because it's just too suspenseful to miss.
And here's why. You've got the Syrian president, a soft-spoken eye doctor and a dictator who's given very few interviews to foreign media since the start of the civil war in 2011. And then there's Rami Makhlouf, Assad's cousin on his mother's side. Makhlouf is a billionaire. His financial empire in Syria spans everything from telecommunications to real estate, construction, and oil. The government in Syria has been a family affair since the 1970s, when Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, seized power through a coup. Assad, the father, ruled Syria for 30 years. He groomed his son, Basil, to take over. But he died in a car crash in 1994, and that's how the younger brother, Bashar, became Syria's president. But through the years, the inner workings of the powerful Assad family remained under close wraps. On the surface, President Assad and his cousin, Makhlouf, seemed close.
Salaamu Allah alaykum wa rahmatihi wa barakatihi.
Then, late last month, the Syrian public got a rare glimpse into the secretive world of the ruling clan. Makhlouf posted a video on Facebook. Sitting on the floor of what seems to be a posh villa, Rami Makhlouf explained that the Syrian government has ordered him to pay roughly $250 million in unpaid taxes. "I'm happy to pay," he said, "because I support you, Mr. President. But how could a person like me steal from his own country?" Here's Asar Khattab again.
No one expected to see Rami Makhlouf, the mysterious, strong businessman, cousin of the president, sitting on the floor and pleading to the president, seemingly not having any other means of communicating with his cousin now.
Makhlouf wasn't done. A week later, he posted a second video, and then a third. Bashar, the president, hasn't responded directly, but his government has. One after another, government documents started to pop up online. One gives away how many shares Makhlouf owns in Syria's banks. Another, reportedly issued by the finance ministry, shows an order to seize Makhlouf's assets. Then there's the document that bans Makhlouf from leaving the country.
This is the side of the Syrian state that we have never seen before. Some people view it as that the Assad family has finished devouring the state and its resources, and now they started to devour each other.
It's not exactly clear what is behind this spat between Assad and his cousin, but former Syrian diplomat Bassam Barbandi says it could turn out to be crucial in holding Syrian officials accountable. Barbandi, who worked for the Syrian government until 2013, says the money in dispute is not even in Syria anymore.
I firmly believe the money is outside Syria, in Europe, in Romania, in Dubai, in Moscow.
He thinks American and European officials should be watching this dispute closely.
So if I'm in the Treasury, I think I will see a lot of big money is moving in the market in a way that doesn't make sense. And I think this is opportunity for the Treasury or for US government and the EU in general to confiscate this money or to freeze this money.
The US and EU put Rami Makhlouf under sanctions in 2008. Asar Khattab, the journalist, expects more of this high-level family feud to play out in public. And with every new revelation, he says, Syrians will come to understand more about the family that has ruled their country for 5 decades. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has a lot on his hands right now. He's recovered from COVID-19, but the UK has the most deaths in Europe from the disease, and the British economy remains in free fall. But Johnson's attention for 3 days now has been focused on defending the behavior of his key political advisor, Dominic Cummings. According to reports, Cummings flouted the rules of Britain's lockdown, causing widespread public anger. Cummings says he doesn't regret his actions.
I think that what I did was actually reasonable in these circumstances.
The World's Orla Barry joins us from London. So what did Dominic Cummings actually do, Orla?
So near the end of March, Marco, you will remember that the UK was under a very strict lockdown. And at the time, you couldn't leave your house unless you were going out for essential groceries or one bout of exercise, or if you were a key worker. And at the time, Dominic Cummings drove 260 miles to his parents' home. And he said he did so because his wife had coronavirus symptoms. She was with him in the car and their child was with them. And they did so because they wanted someone to be there in case he got the coronavirus to look after their son. He did get the symptoms of it at the very least. But according to government rules, if you have the symptoms, you stay at home for 7 days. And he flouted the rules. And this was the first way in which he flouted the rules.
What is the second way he flouted the rules? Because this has become a really big deal.
So the second way was he was spotted at Barnard Castle, which is about 30 miles away from his parents' home. He was there on Easter Sunday. Also, coincidentally, was his wife's birthday. But what Dominic Cummings said he was doing was he wanted to test his eyesight for a possible drive back to London. He was wondering whether his eyesight was OK because he said it felt a bit weird. And he decided he was going to test it on a 30-mile drive to Barnard Castle.
And presumably there's no optometrist in the car.
Indeed, there were many optometrists out today saying, if you want to test your eyesight, please don't get behind the wheel to do so.
Why is this such a big deal? Because of his proximity to 10 Downing Street?
Precisely. I mean, I think there's two things going on. We've been through a fairly strict lockdown process. Most people did stay indoors and didn't leave their houses. So they didn't visit their parents, their elderly relatives. There's many, many reports over the last few days of people who had family members who died and died alone because they couldn't go and visit them. And here you had a government advisor, essentially, who was the man behind developing the lockdown rules, and he was the one who went and flouted it. The second reason, I guess, is the person that we're dealing with and the man himself that we're dealing with, Dominic Cummings. He is a very divisive figure. I think it's fair to say he's loathed in some circles, particularly among the opposition. But there are members of the Conservative Party, the government's own party, who also dislike him. He's quite a gruff character. He doesn't have a very pleasant demeanour towards the press. So he has a lot of enemies out there in the first place.
Yes. So those Conservative MPs in Boris Johnson's own party, how are they responding to this news?
Enormously divided, really. In the last few days, there was a flurry of remarkably similar tweets came from some Conservative MPs defending Dominic Cummings. And this morning you had Senior Cabinet Minister Michael Gove coming out in support of Cummings.
When I read the story, I was convinced that there would be an explanation from Dominic because I know that he's a man of honour and integrity. People will make their own mind up. And as Dominic himself said, there'll be many people who will think that his actions were wrong or mistaken. But looking at it in the round, I think that his actions were reasonable.
But as the day continued, Marco, there's been more and more voices of dissent from within the Conservative Party. One of those is MP Roger Gale.
This is a man at the top of the government who had devised and was trying to enforce rules upon one set of people that he doesn't appear to have wanted to obey himself. By saying, I'm going to do what I like, but you can't do what you like, I'm afraid, and this is the bottom line on this, he has sent out a very damaging, very dangerous message.
Orla, it's hard to imagine this is not damaging to Boris Johnson's own political fortunes, is it?
Yeah, there was a poll out this morning that showed that Boris Johnson's own popularity rating has dropped by 20 points in the last five days. People from all sides appear to have lost faith in Boris Johnson.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The pandemic is forcing many of us to change our habits. But what if those habits are deeply ingrained, as in thousands of years ingrained? That's the case in China, where sharing food using your own chopsticks is a sign of respect. The World's Rebecca Canther is in Shanghai and reports the government is trying to change that.
On television stations around China, this public service announcement has been playing over and over for the past month. In it, a three-generation family sits down for a meal, and a cute little kid pedals over on his tricycle, bringing the eating utensils. There's a pair of chopsticks for each person, and also a set of serving chopsticks. The message? Make sure to use the serving chopsticks. It's all part of a new campaign run by the government to try to convince people here to change how they eat. In China, it's very common to share a meal together family style, each person using their own chopsticks to pick up food from a common dish. And it's a sign of caring or respect to pick up food with your own chopsticks and put it on someone else's plate. But as the country recovers from the coronavirus outbreak, the government wants everyone to change that tradition. At an upscale Cantonese restaurant in Shanghai, Tang Xuexiong is surrounded by 12 of his friends and business partners. They're having a post-COVID reunion in a private VIP room. Before them lies a vast array of mouth-watering dishes, including fried fish, shrimp cakes, and clay pot rice. The group clinks glasses for a toast before they dig in. Tang asks the waiter for special chopsticks and serving spoons to serve the dishes. We used serving chopsticks before, he tells me. But after the outbreak, we need to really step up the use of serving utensils to keep everyone healthy. The message is being spread through TV shows and online classes for kids. This teacher in Beihai, in southern China, is showing kids how to distinguish between serving chopsticks and regular ones. The serving ones are longer, and sometimes they're a different color, too. There's even catchy little ditties, like this one featuring a dancing pair of chopsticks. Anita Lai runs food tours, and her family owns a bunch of hot pot restaurants in Chengdu. She says she learned about the chopstick campaign on the radio.
So they've been talking about it and said, like, many restaurants have joined this campaign. And I have seen many restaurants outside of the restaurant. They put up posters and signs saying, like, we encourage people to use the serving chopsticks.
She thinks the new campaign is going to be a tough sell, though.
Using a public or serving chopsticks will kind of be like a sign saying, like, you know, I want to keep distance between you and me. And that's something that's kind of like opposite of the social culture here. Although, like, I agree, it's a good concept that we probably should adapt regarding the pandemic situation.
Anthony Zhao is a chef who owns several restaurants in Shanghai. He says the fancy places have been offering serving chopsticks for years.
Whenever people come in, they walk into the room that the table already set up with serving chopsticks. But sometimes people using, sometimes people not, but it's always will be there.
Zhao says it's a different story in the smaller restaurants where most people go out for regular meals. He says hygiene isn't as much a priority.
Those small restaurants, they were not using serving chopstick because they think it's not necessary. It doesn't really matter.
Serving chopsticks are already common in Taiwan and Japan, but they haven't quite caught on yet in China, despite repeated efforts by the government. So will people start using them? Zhao says it's not like in the U.S. where no one wants to double dip. Here, it seems rude not to do that. People will think,
if you don't want to eat with us, why you can't come, you know? We're already sitting in the same table and being very close to eat, you know? Why you worry about those things? That's how I feel, actually, sometimes.
Back at the Cantonese restaurant in Shanghai, the manager shows me the utensil drawer filled with serving spoons and serving chopsticks. He tells me everyone uses serving chopsticks here. But that's not what I see when I look around the restaurant. There are several people sharing food with the regular chopsticks. This isn't surprising. In China, people have been eating this way for generations. Still, the pandemic has forced people to change in many different ways. It seems they're already accustomed to wearing masks, sharing a digital health code on their phone, and having their temperature checked everywhere they go. So maybe using serving chopsticks will become another small price to pay for staying safe. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Life is funny even when it isn't. It's what makes the job of comedians possible. Right now, though, they've got to find the funny buried beneath a public health crisis, an economic crisis, and no live audiences. Yeah, not so easy. Patrick Cox tells us how a couple of foreign-born U.S.-based comedians are navigating this new reality.
Joanna Houseman and Joe Wong make people laugh for a living, and they do it by drawing attention to the difference between the countries they grew up in, Venezuela and China, and the United States.
Being a Venezuelan living abroad is kind of like being someone who does CrossFit. The moment someone brings up the topic, we cannot shut up about it. Because to delve into Venezuela is like unpacking a little Russian doll of horrors.
Trump wants to build a wall to stop immigration. I'm from China. So I know a lot about walls. They don't work.
That's Joe Wong on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, back when there were studio audiences. And before that, Joanna Hausman in one of her YouTube videos. Hausman rarely works in front of a live audience, so her adjustment to the isolation of lockdown has been easier, sort of.
I left New York City right before everything sort of hit the fan to come visit my parents in Western Massachusetts. So I'm in the Berkshires, isolated from any other human being other than my family.
And so her family has become the subject of her quarantine videos.
I'm getting this weird sadistic pleasure of giving my parents a taste of their own medicine. And I don't mean like the nurturing and constant love and support part. I mean like the annoying part.
Ma!
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 Can you help me with the laundry? You know, a lot of people are like, oh, revenge is like murdering someone that killed your family member. But revenge can also be stifling the people you love the most with constant mothering.
Hausman actually can't imagine going through the pandemic without having family around. She says in Latin America, it's the norm.
In Latin America, we have these multi-generational homes. So for me, the idea of going through this pandemic without some semblance of a family structure that I've lived with my whole life, for me, it just felt impossible. It felt so daunting. Back home in Venezuela, the people that are with the most amount of family members are doing the best. And those that are the most isolated are not doing so great. And, you know, in Venezuela, I think it's particularly hard now that, you know, the light goes out, the water goes out.
None of that's going on in Western Massachusetts, but Hausman doesn't have the professional crew she normally works with, so she's enlisted her younger cousin, who's learning on the fly how to edit video. It's been liberating, she says, the realization that her work doesn't need to be perfect.
There's no reason why I shouldn't post that video that I shot on an iPhone or that weird front-facing video of my mom yelling at me 100 times in Spanish, what am I doing as I go about my day. There's no reason not to upload it.
Staying at home has been more of a challenge for Joe Wong. He's mainly a stand-up comedian, feeding off live audiences. Plus, he's a star not just here, but in his native China too, where he hosts a game show called Is It True? Wong was supposed to be recording a new season of Is It True, but it's been postponed. Instead, he's at home in Southern California. He has a 13-year-old American-born son, who he's trying to cook for.
The tough part about that is, you know, kids are too honest. He's like, oh, daddy, the chicken tastes like tofu. I'm like, what do you mean? That is tofu. he's not happy with my cooking.
Wong's also doing some work online, Instagram Live, YouTube. But frankly, he isn't doing much comedy. Instead, he's using his platform to speak out against the recent spate of virus-related attacks on Asian Americans. Here's a recent post on his YouTube channel.
A doctor in Boston was attacked simply because she's Asian. The reality is, Asians are only 5% of the U.S. population. And now we're the target. Everyone should really speak up and act up. Report, fight back, and help each other. Thank you very much and stay safe.
Wong's new activism is rooted in his past experiences in the U.S., going back to his time as a grad student in the 1990s.
I remember when my school first started, we had a foreign student advisor who told us the key of living in America is to be slow to take offense. That's my old attitude, you know, just let it slide. And I didn't know what I meant at the time. And later on, I gradually realized that, you know, it's just a way to tell you not to speak up when you see something wrong.
Joe Wong is still a comedian, but he thinks he'll be a different one in the future, confronting racial hypocrisy, willing to alienate some in his audience. That's what he's concluded during these months at home.
I know time is really tough, but maybe from this experience, you can look back on your life and find out exactly what you want to do next. Try a new approach to your old task or your old career.
Joe Wong's quarantine introspection is something he shares with Joanna Hausman, two bilingual performers whose comedy is being reshaped by the events of this year. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
One thing about the lockdowns, we've seen some incredible talent that we might not otherwise have known about. People just being themselves, singing their songs.
I was never really into music till I was about 9 years old. But now I can't control myself from grooving.
That's how Sela Su, a Belgian singer-songwriter, approached her music on her debut album in 2011. She's been singing from her soul years before lockdown was a common part of a vocabulary, singing for herself like it was the only thing she wanted to do. When Sela Su was 17, a Belgian producer had her record some demos he'd composed and steered her to a record contract. She turned down the offer because she wanted to sing her own songs. When she was established and opening for acts like Prince, Sela Su was convinced she had taken the right path. She spoke with Mojo magazine a few years ago about the advice she got from Prince on that tour.
He said to me, it's important to learn about the business because they're all sharks. And then and also it's important to do everything yourself. But I'm like, yo, Prince, I'm really much more lazy than you. You know, I don't want to do it myself. But he said, I can see you breathe music, so never take any lessons, which is good because it feeds me in my laziness. So it was all good. It was perfect.
Sela Su has just released a new collection of her songs, including a single called You. She wrote it just after the birth of her first child.
Hope a little spark will come our way.
Sela Su from Belgium there, providing a calming influence for her newborn, not to mention for the rest of us. The song is called You. Saying goodbye to you this Tuesday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, but always online 24/7 at theworld.org. We'll see you there and back here tomorrow on the radio.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.